attitude. John, I don't think you have what it takes to get through trigonometry. How about we make a welder out of you? I was going to be headed to college because I was not planning to work in a field so low as mechanics or clothing fabrication or forfend woodworking. I even worked at a couple of trades, namely house framing and blacktopping, in order to earn money for my college education. Only later, as a penniless actor, would I recall the robust wages I earned at those quote-unquote low jobs, while all around me, friends with degrees in everything from business to political science were earning the minimum wage as depressed baristas. A main focus of this indecency, in Mr. Berry's view, is what this attitude has done to the small farmer. A particularly insidious American dream is being whispered into the ears of our young people as soon as they can hear a television set that things will be better for them someplace else. It also feeds our conditioning as consumers that we'll be happier if we can just get that new car, home, swimming pool, or wife. I was lucky to grow up in a household where that message was refuted, despite our youthful desires to honor it. The reason his writing struck me so profoundly and stays with me, unflagging, is because it's precisely what my admirable, wholesome parents taught me, just in an extremely well-written package. Mr. Berry also had some welcome things to say about limitations. He mentioned an Amish neighbor who lived by an excellent rule. He refuses to harness a beast after supper. This regulates how much acreage he is able to farm and thereby puts a comfortable limit on himself and his family and his animals. In direct contrast to this, we were driving a couple of towns over and we had to clear well off the road while a veritable parade of John Deere combines, tractors, and wagons paraded past, looking sincerely like something out of a frightening science fiction film. These machines were the size of buildings. Wendell shook his head and said, "That's just no way to farm." I know what he's getting at, and yet I think we both feel for these small farmers who have fallen victim to a system by which they can never seem to get out in front of the corporate interests. Those who sell them their seed, dominate the market, and approve them for million-dollar loans that they'll never be able to pay off. We continued driving up a lane through the woods to a venerable, solitary wooden structure. He said, "I thought you might like to see this." He thought right. In his old barn, we guessed at the probable history of the used timbers, based upon the mortises, or joint holes, located in peculiar places. Wendell had a solid theory that the structural upright posts had once housed a pulley wheel based upon the remaining joinery. In the main bay of the barn sat some disused antique tobacco equipment, including a little two-horse riding cultivator. It was a steel V with the bottom of the V pointing forward like a skein of geese. Beneath the frame were small trowel-shaped plowing shoes, which had adjustable fixtures for angle and depth and such, with a seat on the point of the V for the driver. He said it was a McCormick Deering, and you'd do eight rows. There's about 1,000 ways you could adjust these things to get the furrows turned just right. They would do what the old people called pretty work. They'd say, "That's pretty work." I was quite taken with that. These days, who among us can say with any regularity, "That's pretty work"? The fact that most of what we do in modern America doesn't fall into that category is precisely what he's driving at in his writing. You know who does get to say it? The kids who went to vocational school. The welder, the seamstress, the cobbler, the potter. Those who work with their hands. Those who work in jobs in the only category that is so devalued that most schools in the country have fully cut their shop and home economics programs. Creating a deficiency even more elemental, our kids are no longer being taught to write in cursive. This seems so short-sighted and flatly idiotic to those of us not in love with our pocket televisions. We're being trained into a complete homogeny, and we're all just going along with it. Tanya asked me especially to point up the folly in that exclusion of this most basic life skill. This general state of affairs was getting me down until I began touring the country as a humorist and talking about the imperative value of pursuits like knitting and boat building, and I began to meet young people everywhere who were curious and excited about working with their hands. I am also encouraged by the growing locavore movement, in which small local farm operations are being sustained by the increasing awareness of the importance of locally sourced agriculture. At Wendell Berry's table, I said as much that I considered myself a bit of a Michael Pollan optimist, a word choice for which I was immediately taken to task. The programs of optimism and pessimism are cop-outs because you're taking the responsibility off of yourself to keep trying. Soundly admonished, I could only nod in agreement with his truth. He meant that in either case, you were excusing yourself from responsibility in a given situation, as in, well, I think everything will turn out well, so let's go watch TV, or nothing is possibly going to turn out well, so let's go watch TV. He also told a story about a recent community victory of which they'd been a part at the courthouse, fighting an unsavory land developer. Usually, you go in there not expecting to win, but sometimes you get a little surprise. Now, if you're an optimist, you never get a little surprise. He said that instead of subscribing to optimism, he understands that he's hopeful because he knows the right work to do and he's going to do it. He went on, I want to deal with people who are at work because they see the real reasons to be at work. That's what I call hope, if they can keep going. But I keep telling young people, if you get into this with the idea that you're going to win, you're not going to last. The reason to get into it is because it's right, and because it's interesting work to do, and because you're enjoying it. If you're not having any fun, you better quit right now. And his opinions aren't always popular either. Wendell Berry is hardcore. In 1987, Harper's Magazine published an essay of his entitled, Why I Am Not Going to Buy a Computer. In it, Mr. Berry neatly lists the very sensible and practical reasons that he prefers to write with a pencil or pen and then have his work typed and edited by his wife, Tanya. Harper's then printed a handful of letters in response to the essay, in which the writers snidely criticized Mr. Berry's position on a few counts, including some very mean comments about his use of Tanya, allowing Berry to then respond to his detractors, provided one of the most entertaining and again fairly presented, comprehensive literary drubbings I have seen. It was so enjoyable that Mike Schur, my dear friend and creator of Parks and Recreation, was inspired to write his lengthy senior term paper about Wendell Berry and the argument back in 1993. In fact, knowing this about Mike, I might even go so far as to theorize that some vestiges of Wendell Berry remained with him in so meaningful enough a way as to contribute to the overall stance of my taciturn character, Ron Swanson. Consider this statement from Berry's computer essay. A number of people by now have told me that I could greatly improve things by buying a computer. My answer is that I am not going to do it. I have several reasons, and they are good ones. If that's not Swansonian dialogue, then I don't know what I'm about, son. We were talking about good work. The method of unheated debate by which Mr. Berry makes complete jackasses out of Bradley C. Johnson and James Rhodes and Nathaniel S. Borenstein is unyielding. Their insulting comments prompted Wendell Berry to call them audacious and irresponsible gossips, which is merely his opening salvo. He then lays them out one by one, standing firmly on the moral high ground because he speaks factually. The man does his homework and then brings simple facts to bear objectively upon his topic. It's quite clear that he's pissed, but it's amazing how he trounces their sneering opinions without ever once having to pay deference to his emotions. This is a type of good work. In 1993, Wendell Berry published an essay entitled Christianity and the Survival of Creation, in which he begins by stating that a pulpit is always a forcible reminder to him that he is an essayist and in many ways a dissenter. I find that this proclamation brings me comfort because he's telling us that his own opinions are drawn from a well-considered personal assessment of the accepted wisdom. I'm comforted that a person with the horse sense of Wendell Berry is keeping an eye on things and reporting back to us that many aspects of modern society are in serious need of rethinking. That essay, for example, is a terribly satisfying dressing down of contemporary big Christianity, specifically in its tacit support of the industrial economy, which translates to a failure in honoring as God's holy creation every last bit of the natural world, even the, quote, biting and dangerous beasts, unquote. The sound comeuppance with which he slaps ecologically ignorant Christians about the face would also make Rocky Balboa quiver in his fancy tall boxing shoes. One of the main reasons that I am so passionate about Wendell Berry's writing is because I very strongly agree with a great many of his stances, but he is able to couch them so damn much better than I ever could. Besides his smarts and his talent and his particular combination of timing and terroir and perspective, I also believe that his thoughts are so well articulated thanks to his understanding of pace. He has written in more than one place of the severe disadvantages brought about by our accelerated modern living. Time was, a body either walked to town or rode at the speed of a horse. At that pace, one would have the opportunity to soak in the details all around, with all the senses coming into play. You could see past your neighbor's house into the garden and discern that they were still having worm trouble with their tomatoes. That time has long since passed, and now we travel at the speed of the automobile, hermetically sealed off from the smells and the sounds of the neighborhood, zipping along too quickly to take in much beyond the mailboxes. I am postulating that, by willfully keeping his boat pulled over in the slack water of progress, Mr. Berry has also given himself the gift of time to think things through properly and completely, in a way that the vast majority of us would find incomprehensible. The advantage he has culled by figuratively refusing to harness a beast after supper, that is a type of good work. We were talking about good work. In the Christianity essay, he also tells us, if we understand that no artist, no maker, can work except by reworking the works of creation, then we see that by our work, by the way we practice our arts, we reveal what we think of the works of God. These questions cannot be answered by thinking, but only by doing. In his excellent book, Why We Make Things and Why It Matters, Peter Korn makes a similarly philosophical argument for handcrafting items such as furniture, and I quote, prior to the Industrial Revolution, virtually every object had been produced by hand. Subsequent to it, making things by hand became a potentially subversive act, something one did in opposition to prevailing societal norms. End quote. Korn's thoughtful book makes a persuasive case for the ways in which we choose to make items with our hands. Quote, the handmade desk is at odds with our society's rampant consumerism. It speaks of durability at a time when most goods are disposable. Then, furniture, after all, is more than an object of contemplation. It is a prescription for the life to be lived around it. End quote. That is certainly a type of good work. Mr. Berry's essay, Life is a Miracle, is rife with assertions culminating in a wary defense of the mysteries of art and of life itself. A favorite passage goes like this. Good artists are people who can stick things together so that they stay stuck. They know how to gather things into formal arrangements that are intelligible, memorable, and lasting. Good forms confer good health upon the things that they gather together. Farms, families, and communities are forms of art, just as are poems, paintings, and symphonies. None of these things would exist if we did not make them. We can make them either well or poorly. This choice is another thing we make. However, despite the beauty of his words, his life, and his career, I believe that he would want me to urge you to refrain from running out and trying to start a farm of your own. As he put it, for God's sake, people who know how to farm are failing. I used to get down on myself because the schedules in my household aren't conducive to raising even a garden, let alone a crop of more significance. We work on the road for many months out of the year, and so I could pay someone to tend my garden, but that would feel a bit too gentleman farmer to me. What I've realized, however, is that there is no need to be so literal with my pursuit of a berry-infused lifestyle. I must simply look around for the patch of fecund ground that will accept my turnips, a euphemism, and grow the produce of affection where I may. Thus, I realized that my woodshop is my garden. It is there that I am a member of a fellowship. Our dusty gang of studious woodworkers work together and separately to achieve a robust harvest year in and year out. Even there, I am more than half absentee, but I remain in correspondence as though they were my lifeline, because they are. Answering a question about glue choice or spline placement from afar can feed me for days. I actively pursue a continuous fidelity with my woodworkers because together we make a life of craft in which we take raw wood and transform it into beautiful and useful implements. Chairs, ukuleles, baseball bats, canoes. I feel like what gets done at Offerman Woodshop can be considered a type of good work. I also plant my flowers in my writing and in my work as an actor, and I love to see those efforts blossom. Although I must confess that I will always nurture a fantasy of setting up shop on a little farm one day and raising the finest bacon in the county with a healthy crop of garlic, just like my dad's. Mr. Berry has written a great many poems, some of which call us to action, with lines like, "Be joyful, though you have considered all the facts," and some of which call to mind the beauty of a river bank with its attendant leaves and birds and insects and sky and breeze. But the one I will share with you is not of that stripe. It is Wendell Berry telling the magnificent truth as only he can. A warning to my readers. Do not think me gentle because I speak in praise of gentleness, or elegant because I honor the grace that keeps this world. I am a man crude as any, gross of speech, intolerant, stubborn, angry, full of fits and furies. That I may have spoken well at times is not natural. A wonder is what it is. He is eloquent. He is beautiful. And he is funny as shit. I have left out so much. There is a cornucopia of beauty and joy and mirth and tragedy and romance and charm and nature and humanity to be found in his writing. There is a bumper crop of common sense. Perhaps his greatest talent is to be found in his proclivity for telling it like it is. As our conversation waned around the Barry's kitchen table, Mr. Barry said, "Well, you want to see my barn? I'll show you my barn." I replied, "Boy, I won't turn down that invitation. But then get me out of your hair. I don't want to overstay my welcome." He said, "All right. Well, when we get back in, you can leave." Then we giggled. Chapter 10. The Legislator. Barney Frank. I love you. You love me. We're a happy family. Would that these words were describing the slogan of our nation's population. Despite my infrequent indulgence in television, not to mention my adult age, these are the words that come to mind when I hear the name Barney, as they are the theme song from a children's television show that was so ubiquitous in the 1990s that it jumps to the fore of any associations. I also think of Barney Fife and Barney Rubble, two characters who brought me a great deal of enjoyment in my younger years, with their supporting sidekick hijinks on The Andy Griffith Show and The Flintstones, respectively. As my adult attention, however, has been drawn slightly away from cartoons and ever increasingly toward the real world in which we live, a new Barney has emerged to capture my notice with his actions of a decidedly more protagonist nature. Barney Frank, an American Democrat from Massachusetts' 4th District, who served in the U.S. House of Representatives for 32 years, from 1981 to 2013, is considered to be our country's most prominent gay politician. As a reputation, most famous gay politician could be seen as a substantial bit of gossipy clickbait. Really, quite an attention grabber. But the charismatic thing about this redoubtable fellow is that his accomplishments speak much more loudly than his sexual orientation. His record shows that he has been a legislator in the truest sense of the word. From the moment he arrived on the political scene in Boston in the early 1970s, he has been advocating for those positions he deemed in need of his attentions, not to mention his bulldog-like tenacity and his well-sharpened wit. Although he remained closeted about his own sexuality until 1987, Mr. Frank introduced Massachusetts' first two gay rights bills in 1973. In May of 1980, Barney Frank won his first congressional election, gaining the seat abandoned by Father Robert Drynan when Pope John Paul II issued an order for all priests to step down from political office. Said Barney Frank, "The irony was pretty clear. I think I said at the time that apparently papal infallibility doesn't extend to picking members of Congress. And I've since asked people who know something about me to name the unlikeliest person in the whole world who would have wanted to make me a congressman, and very few of them get it." Although he was still years away from coming out publicly, Mr. Frank was asked by a local LGBT rights organization if he would support a bill for gay rights, to which he said yes. Little did he suspect that he would be the solitary signee, and so he became, in one fell swoop, the instant leader of the movement for gay rights in Massachusetts and then the nation. Thank you, Holy Father. Since then, he has remained one of the nation's leading proponents of LGBT rights. In case you're not familiar with that initialism, it stands for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender. Please allow me to begin this particular conversation with a warning, not to you, but to myself. I would like to caution myself against becoming too emotional in my writing about discrimination against homosexuals. Something I discussed with Mr. Frank was the increasing ineffectuality of impassioned partisanship, or more simply put, shouting. In past writing, I have expressed some opinions in an emotional fashion that, while honest, I now feel to be less than the ideal volume at which to communicate, if I wish the listener to remain fully open to my ideas. I have been warned. To you, dear listener, I would issue only an entreaty. Regardless of your politics, your religion, or your shoe size, please consider these following thoughts with an open mind. Let's take a moment to examine the trait of homosexuality. I think trait is acceptable, a condition born of nature, like hair color or height. There's a lot of well-earned prickliness around the terminology of gay culture since it has become such a hotly contested topic. For example, sexual preference is a serious no-no, since one of the ignorant claims made by the ignorant is that homosexuality is a choice rather than a natural-born state of being. It is this misconception that causes Christian organizations to suggest that homosexuals should be able to pray the gay away, as though it was as impermanent and superficial a condition as dandruff or a sunburn, or at worst, an addiction or sickness like alcoholism. In truth, they might just as well encourage their congregants to pray away their blood types or perhaps their eye color. The cruelty of this attempted brainwashing, especially in children, is yet another factor of this conversation that makes my blood boil. Again, these groups of vicious people who profess to follow the teachings of Christ, who embarrass themselves in the arena of mercy by afflicting their followers with guilt and denial rather than embracing them, are shameful and abhorrent. Gay-free churches may be the biggest asswipes under the banner of heaven. Oops, there I go. But at least they are not engaging in the far more brutal discriminations that have plagued homosexuals throughout history. It's no wonder that Barney Frank remained in the closet as he rose to prominence in his career. The America in which he lived instructed him to do just that if he hoped to advance without being unfairly persecuted because of the flavor of person he desired to kiss. For Hollywood actors and actresses, politicians, and to some extent professional athletes, all performers of different stripes who depend upon the approbation, adulation, or at least approval of the masses to retain any semblance of job security, the specter of open homosexuality and its concomitant disapproval presents far too great a risk. As Mr. Frank said to me of discriminatory behavior, I think that there are some people who genuinely don't realize that it's offensive. There are some who are just bigots who want to offend, but there are some people who have been brought up this way, and they have not fully thought about the fact that it's very, very insulting. Here's the thing, team. No matter what you have been raised to believe about anyone with a sexual orientation other than heterosexual, the simple fact is that being gay is as inbred to the human being as is his or her back hair. The only folks who seem to disagree with that statement are some sects of Christianity, who are basing their opinions upon a few Bible verses that reference sodomy. Islam also considers homosexuality a crime against Allah, but I feel like the vitriol toward same-sex marriage in this country is rather monopolized by self-professed Christians. I'm unaware of a prominent American politician who is Muslim making anywhere near as much illogical noise as the likes of outspoken Republican and Tea Party politicians, Ted Cruz, Sarah Palin, Rick Perry, Michelle Bachmann, and Tom DeLay, who said in a 2014 interview, "I think we got off the track when we allowed our government to become a secular government, when we stopped realizing that God created this nation, that He wrote the Constitution, that it's based on biblical principles." Hilarious, but frightening. Now you see, if I hadn't given myself that careful warning earlier, it's language like what Mr. DeLay said right there that would cause me to become very emotional. Even now, I can feel my knickers threatening to get themselves into a twist, but instead, I will endeavor to emulate that great practitioner of common sense, Wendell Berry. In his essay, Caught in the Middle, he describes the way in which all creatures can be considered of a kind, or kin, all members of one family, as we surely are. He tells us, much happiness, much joy can come to us from our membership in a kindness so comprehensive and original. It is a shame, as I know from long acquaintance with myself, to be divided from it by the autoerotic pleasure of despising other members. This is a very important human truth to recognize. It feels good to despise those who are different from us. It is precisely this aspect of human nature that I am trying to arrest in myself so that I may look past our differences and such policies to focus upon what it is we all share as Americans. Sentiments like that of Mr. DeLay and those in agreement with his ilk when it comes to opposing same-sex marriage in our country are flatly dehumanizing to any citizens who wish to live within a marriage and who happen to be other than heterosexual. The sad thing is, at their core, religious writings like the Bible are founded upon beautiful wisdom and guidance for how we might live in kindness. But when such verses are appropriated by humans like DeLay to support more petty and hateful means, the original intent is not only lost, it's completely desecrated. Mr. Frank said this to me of religious texts. It's very lovely what they're talking about. Sadly, an awful lot of people think they're a great stick to hit other people with and use as a weapon rather than a way to embrace people. He makes my point and Mr. Berry's point beautifully. Aren't Christians supposed to embrace people? Love thy neighbor as thyself? I have never witnessed as much vitriol and seething hatred in public politicking as that issuing forth from these particular Christians in regard to such issues with their quote-unquote neighbors. When Mr. DeLay, a prominent former congressperson from Texas, made that statement, he urinated on both the Bible and the Constitution. Our nation is the greatest nation on earth for exactly the opposite reason of his speech. The Constitution protects us from such a silly idea, so that wherever you come down on the subject of the Bible or any other religion, you will be treated with an equal amount of fairness as the next citizen. His statement is patently anti-American as well as patently unholy. The last time I checked, the Bible was not concerned with limiting its benevolence with respect to the borders of any nation, including ours. This sort of absurd rhetoric strikes me as having strong similarities to the communist paranoia of McCarthyism and the hysteria of the Salem witch trials. His stance would be laughable if it weren't for the fact that people like him are being elected to political offices of the highest importance, where they can encourage the perseverance of discrimination. Back to the good guy. Besides his triumphs in equal rights and financial reform, from 2007 to 2011, he also served as chairman to the House Committee on Financial Services, where he was instrumental in co-sponsoring the Dodd-Frank Act of 2010. Barney Frank has also been a great champion of civil rights throughout his 16 terms in Congress. His ability to garner deals that cross party lines has been admirable, considering the virulent bipartisanship ruling our current White House. He said that the members of Congress can be openly duplicitous, depending upon when the timing of any proposed initiative relates to the timing of their primaries. I had one moderate Republican. I asked him to support us on the question of protecting transgendered people against discrimination, and he said to me, "Well, if it comes up after my primary, I can probably vote with you, but if it comes up before that, I have to vote against you." This sense of being seen by one's constituents as strictly Democrat or Republican is an issue that has really begun to stick in my own craw. As Barney Frank tells it, 20 years ago, people had a common set of facts that they read, They got their information generally from newspapers and broadcasts. Now the activists, left and right, live in parallel universes, which are both separate and echo chambers for each. This juxtaposition has occurred to me in recent years, as I have begun to feel like our politics are yet another area in which we are being trained to blindly consume the messaging that we're being fed, either by the liberal channels of Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert, MSNBC, and the Huffington Post, or conversely, by the Fox News, Rush Limbaugh side of any debate. Regardless of our red or blue team membership, we all rather lazily follow along with what we are told to hate about the policies of the opposing side. This leaves no middle ground, which it seems to me is where most of life actually resides. Because of the black or white commodification of our votes, candidates are no longer allowed to say, "Hey, let's stop and examine this issue from any perspective but the far left or right." I am a great fan of the humorous news programs like John Oliver's and Colbert's, but Barney Frank makes a good point when he notices that their messaging is almost exclusively negative. Funny, yes. Poignant, yes. True, yes. But is it helping us toward any progress? There is a difference in kindness, certainly, a most substantial difference, between your John Oliver and your Sean Hannity or Rush Limbaugh. The difference is that Oliver has it. When Oliver gets loud, he does so to condemn a person's or organization's actions. Also, his is a comedy show, including self-deprecation, lending the silly presentation a softening quality from the get-go, which I think makes a big distinction from the right-wingers who are flatly mean and vicious without humor. They are so severe about, quote, saving our country, that their rants remind one of nothing so much as an angry child throwing a tantrum, which is often hilarious to the grown-ups around them, although we must contain our mirth lest we exacerbate their tiny tempests. Bill O'Reilly proves with ever-increasing desperation that when you take yourself that seriously, you are perceived as a joke. But no matter. The delivery systems of each side may differ in taste and decorum by a wide gulf, but their net results are similarly low when it comes to fostering progress. When we tune in to either flavor of entertainment, are any of us lending any brain power to solving these problems? Or are we a righteous, chuckling choir, pumping our respective fists at the drubbing our entertainer has just delivered that asshole across the aisle? If we, all of us, just continue to call one another assholes, then what good is that doing anybody? Will we ever recognize and subsequently tire of the futility of this exercise? As Mr. Frank points out, we used to cull our information from more unbiased sources so that we might then engage in our own conversations, millions of tiny debates on any given topic across the nation, the smallness of which allowed for the influence of local conditions. Citizens in Phoenix are going to have one opinion about Monsanto's development of GMOs, for example, while the farmers in Nebraska will have some very different things to say on the topic. Urban dwellers will invariably exhibit different needs than suburbanites, whose concerns will vary from those of small rural towns. All these disparate opinions combined and weighed to strike a balance somewhere in the middle of our two starkly polarized parties were once a great strength in our nation's politics, a strength that we have evidently all but lost. On both sides of the congressional aisle, this creates a stark divisibility in which it can be hard for our legislators to find compromise. Barney Frank said, "For some politicians, one of the hardest things to do is differ with some of the people you agree with on most issues on any one issue. And people need to learn that that's not a betrayal, because if you want to agree with Stewart 80% of the time and Limbaugh 20%, people get very angry. There's no tolerance for that kind of disagreement within the faction." He then stated that he thought we should adopt a second national anthem, at least in regard to politics. It's all about the base. I said, it's all about the base? He replied, you know, it's all about the base, no treble. I said, ah, yes. The political song is, it's all about the base, no moderates. Thus, did this Democratic firebrand, 30 years my senior, make a clear and effective point whilst simultaneously schooling me in popular culture. I'll confess that I was rather nervous to interview him after listening to and reading several other interviews in which he nimbly demonstrated his ability to vigorously dismantle any agenda and quickly clarify the heart of any matter at hand. Part of the reason I'm typing this here book in the first place is because I've become aware of my blithe ignorance when it comes to politics and my place in them. However, once he made his all-about-the-base joke, I knew that he would be gentle with your humble pilgrim of an author. In a 2012 issue of New York Magazine, he said, "You know, it's the primaries. People who want to be moderate lose. And when we try to compromise, what you find is not people simply objecting to the specific terms of the compromise, but the activists object even to your trying to compromise. Because they say, look, everybody I know agrees with us, so why are you giving in?" Mr. Frank feels that this extreme bipartisanship began to take root in the 1980s. The Republicans were desperate to find a pot in which to piss when Newt Gingrich took it upon himself to demonize the opposition as a new and unscrupulous political tactic. This was followed by the right-wing takeover of the Republican Party, which was followed by this red-blue bifurcation that occurred in modern communications. The modern brand of campaigning, then, utilizing low techniques like slander and attack ads, completely distracts voters from anything resembling a productive conversation, encouraging us instead to violently back our own team, whether it's for or against the fashionable issue of the season, like gun control, immigration, health care, abortion, or same-sex marriage. He wrote, "Condemnation by category is the lowest form of hatred, for it is cold-hearted and abstract, lacking the heat and even the courage of a personal hatred. Categorical condemnation is the hatred of the mob, which makes cowards brave." This quote from Wendell Berry's essay, Caught in the Middle, seems like it could apply equally as well to this brand of political hate-mongering as to the continuing discrimination against homosexuals in our country. This hatred of the mob, of which Wendell Berry writes, I think is what has begun to rankle me when it comes time to vote. With the exception of the exaggerated optimism that surrounded the first campaign of President Obama, which had less to do with tangible issues, I think, than with his generally appealing to a democratic idealism, when's the last time I voted for the candidate who impressed me with proactive results, as opposed to the one who seemed the lesser of two evils? Even the language behind the campaigns is a problem. The terms that surround issues of homosexuality, like tolerance or defense of marriage, have done nothing to assuage my feeling that this long-running prejudice is nothing short of criminal. That any person's sexual orientation should require tolerating is a flagrant example of discrimination. I could sadly name a few altar boys who might have something more tangible to say about tolerating the sexual orientation of their superiors in the sacristy of the church. As for the Defense of Marriage Act, Barney Frank told me, "I asked on the floor of the House, how does a same-sex union threaten your marriage? Anyone who's married, stand up and tell me how it threatens your marriage." So one Republican got up and said, "Well, it doesn't threaten my marriage, it threatens the institution of marriage." I said, "That sounds like an argument that should be made by someone in an institution." This is splendid. As my Parks and Rec co-star Retta would say, Barney Frank got jokes. The Christians who are so offended by homosexuality point to the references in the Bible wherein gay love is described as a perversion, but Mr. Berry fairly points out in Caught in the Middle that he can see no reason why perversion should be reserved as an indiscretion particular only to the homosexuals. It goes without saying that the condemnation of the perfectly normal lifestyle of homosexuals as a perversion is egregious. It again smacks of the elitism of the manifest destiny mentality that allows a veil of false righteousness to cloak the true brutality of a people's actions from their own self-reckoning. Vicious behavior is justified by ideas like God's plan for the white people, or in this case, the straight people. Further, there are plenty of legitimate perversions being enacted by straight people every day with as much gusto as anyone, rendering their complaint rather toothless, or at least powerfully hypocritical. Wendell Berry also hilariously points out that anything going on in the gay bedroom is going on in straight bedrooms as well, with interest. He asks, would conservative Christians like a small government bureau to inspect, approve, and certify their sexual behavior? Would they like a colorful tattoo, verifying government approval on the rumps of lawfully copulating persons? I asked Mr. Frank if the climate of tolerance, you know what, I'm going to say equality, no, decency. If the climate of decency had changed in the halls of Congress since he voluntarily came out in 1987. He said, to use a cliche, it's like night and day. Well, I think dawn and noon would probably be better. When he came out, he explained, his friends tried to talk him out of it because it was assumed that his credibility and approval rating would drop through the floor. In recent years, he has seen that his homosexuality and his marriage to his husband in particular have helped him in the polls more than, say, getting the financial reform bill passed. Like many of the indiscretions we white folks have inflicted upon groups of others over the centuries, discrimination against gays has seen some very colorful chapters historically, colors like black and blue and crimson red primarily. Skipping past the early English punishments for sodomy, like burning alive and hanging, let's zero in on what has been going on in modern-day America. Sodomy, I put in quotes because I'm confused by the term, does it refer merely to sex acts between a gay couple? Seems like a rather prurient topic for the law to concern itself with. The lady doth protest too much. Anyway, sodomy, while no longer considered a capital crime, does remain an offense for which one can be imprisoned in 12 states of our nation as of April 2014. Okay, let's just hang on here and remind ourselves what we're talking about specifically is an act of physical love between two consenting people. In the vernacular of Mr. Berry, then, apparently, 12 state governments still deign to identify unlawfully copulating persons. In the year 1610, Virginia adopted Great Britain's sodomy laws, which basically made the act of copulation between men punishable by death. In 1777, Thomas Jefferson raised eyebrows when he proposed that the penalty for sodomy be reduced from death to castration. I can almost hear the haters demeaning Jefferson. Classic Hollywood liberal! Of course, this proposal was deemed as too lenient and so was never enacted. America's armed forces have also been a hotbed of discrimination and controversy throughout our history. Initially, soldiers could be discharged only if witnessed in flagrante delicto, mano a mano, but after World War II, simply admitting to homosexuality became grounds enough for dismissal. The Army began asking soldiers for their sexual orientation, yet another shameful example of the government sticking its nose where it didn't belong. In 1953, Eisenhower, the President of the United States, Banned gays from employment in the federal government by executive order. And this wasn't repealed until 1975. Oh, hello, we have arrived at Barney Frank. Now we have a little clearer idea of the guts Mr. Frank exhibited in taking up this cause for equality, even years before he himself came out. Despite the very real prejudice that existed then, and is still prevalent, although thankfully somewhat diminished today, he didn't bat an eyelash in his pursuit of legislation that will serve us all in our continuing quest for decency. Simply, he's put up with a lot of shit in 32 years in the House, and he's risen above it. Look, this job certainly didn't make any sense in terms of maximizing my income or minimizing my stress or maximizing the comfort of my life. I think it's a wonderful job to have because I'm able to work to make fundamental changes in society and improve the quality of people's lives and eliminate and diminish unfairness at various times. If I wasn't able to do what I thought was important public policy, it'd be a stupid job to have. Mr. Frank and Mr. Barry and I all seem to agree that we humans are complicated and messy animals in many ways. It's our nature. Despite that nature, in order to fulfill our Founding Fathers' vision of a nation where no persons suffer unfair prejudice, we must find ourselves an uncomfortable place in the middle of issues. If we can all consider gay people, including lesbian and transgender folks, simply folks, only then can we move forward with addressing all the actual tasks we have in front of us. More hugs, less punches. Chapter 11. The Artist. Yoko Ono. Oh, Yoko. If any of you hear her name and think, oh, you mean the no-good so-and-so who broke up the Beatles? Well, let's get that cleared up right off the bat. There happen to be some incredibly satisfying accounts of the Beatles' history in book form. My favorite recently was The Beatles' The Biography by Bob Spitz, that should serve to satisfyingly untangle any misapprehensions we fans might have been under in regard to the forces that actually did bring about the end of the greatest rock band in history. But before that information was available to me, or rather I to it, as a rather simple rube pretty fresh off the sweet corn truck from Illinois, I was certainly subscribing to that particular inaccuracy about Yoko. My beautiful bride set me straight. Yet another reason they call me the lucky bastard. In 2002, Megan announced to me that we would be attending an art opening at the Shoshana Wayne Gallery in Santa Monica, California, and that the opening was for Yoko Ono. I squinted slightly and blinked a couple of times as I determined that, no, this was not some sort of uproarious ruse. What kind of art, I believe I asked. You don't like her, do you? You know, the Beatles? Then it was Megan's turn to gauge my sincerity. She blinked thrice while inhaling, then sighed and, evincing forcible restraint, set down her spatula. She quietly said, "Her art is amazing." Then added with defeat, "You don't know about her art?" I hadn't known one bit, considering all the ways in which I am still profoundly ignorant today after reading a hell of a lot of books. You can only imagine the breadth of my innocence 13 years ago. Megan has been the most tolerant of teachers, understanding inherently that, in my case, the fruits of the tree of knowledge must be plucked, chewed, and digested, but one at a time, if she wants me to keep them down. Fortunately, that night was the perfect time for some fruit. We went to the opening early, because if you're famous, like Megan had become after four seasons of Will and Grace at that point, you can get into the gallery before the public for a preview, which also means you can get dibs on purchasing pieces of art, should you be so inclined, before they get scooped up. Megan is a keen art collector, so she was known to the gallerist, who in turn mentioned her to Yoko. Well, it turns out that Yoko was a very big fan of Will and Grace, and so when we arrived at the preview, she was there to greet us with her son, Sean. If I was incredibly excited to meet Yoko and Sean Ono Lennon, an amazing musician in his own right and a right sweetheart, then Megan was on the roof. Hell, she was over the moon. We all made pals, and Megan and I toured the collection, which included some cloud pieces, as well as a series of photographs of a window in her apartment at the Dakota Building on Central Park. But this was far from Yoko's first gallery showing, by 40 or more years' distance. What Megan had explained to me before we arrived was that Yoko Ono had already been an iconoclastic and groundbreaking conceptual artist when she and John Lennon met in 1966. She had mounted a show in a swell-sounding pad called the Indica Gallery in London, to which John arrived for a preview, Natch, on the invitation of the gallery director John Dunbar. Apparently, Yoko was not a fan of popular music, as she had not heard of John Lennon, but Dunbar explained that he was a rich chap who might like her work and hence buy something. As he toured the work, Lennon noticed an apple for sale for £200. "I thought it was fantastic," he said. "I got the humor in her work immediately. There was a fresh apple on a stand, and it was £200 to watch the apple decompose." First of all, £200 in 1966 pounds was equal to about £3,000 in today's purse. Second, the idea of reducing the artist's participation in the experience to the mere curating of a scenario in which the patron was paying to watch nature work one of her many miracles, in this case, rot, was indeed hilarious, but also visionary. It recalls Michael Pollan's description to me of the Chez Panisse dessert of pear and fig that could not be improved upon. See chapter 12. But in the case of Yoko's apple, one was meant to enjoy the fruit with eyes and nose and, of course, imagination and humor. Now, this was getting good. The more I heard about this early brand of Yoko's mischief, the more I liked it. In the early 60s, according to Alexandra Monroe of the Guggenheim, Yoko was the first artist in 1964 to put language on the wall of the gallery and invite the viewer to complete the work. She was the first to cede authorial authority in this way, making her work interactive and experimental. I'm a tad puzzled by Ms. Monroe's authorial redundancy, but as an aspiring student, I will let it stand, in the name of accuracy, however much it may make my cheeks blush a reddish red. Another piece from 1964 that is considered by some her most courageous work was called Cut Piece. In a more theatrical setting, it was wholly interactive, almost more performance art than a conceptual piece, in which Yoko sat, silent and unmoving, while the audience was invited to approach her and snip away at her clothing with a sizable pair of scissors. Again, for the early 60s, this was shocking material to comprehend. There's a filmed piece of it on YouTube. If you examine it, try to imagine the vulnerability and submissiveness of this tiny, young, beautiful Asian woman, allowing herself to be so subjugated in front of an audience. One young white man, in particular, becomes rather rapacious with his cutting, as though to say, "Well, I'll show you how this is done." The way that makes me feel, that is the artistry of the piece. Yoko has long been a master of using her skills in disparate media to leave her magic roiling, not on the wall or the stereo, but within the brain and heart of the receiver. Megan and I recently saw the excellent documentary Marina Abramovich, The Artist is Present, highly recommended, in which Ms. Abramovich is described as the grandmother of performance art. Megan exclaimed and said, "Make sure you put it in your chapter that Yoko was doing cut piece a decade before Marina even started. Perhaps then, Yoko could be considered the great-grandmother of the medium." The omission seemed too obvious to be accidental, but perhaps it occurred partially due to the world's inability to put a label on the many varied disciplines of Yoko's art. While Abramovich is specifically a performance artist, Yoko Ono defies any one moniker. According to the Guggenheim's Monroe, what makes her so slippery is that she is so wide-ranging. She is a musician and a poet, a peace activist and a performance artist, a maker of objects and a conceptual artist, and married to John Lennon. Speaking of John, let's get back to their first meeting. There was one more item in that Indica Gallery show, the description of which incited me to immediate Yoko discipleship, and it happens to have been the artwork that hooked John Lennon as well, so let's have him describe it. There was another piece that really decided me for or against the artist, a ladder which led to a painting which hung on the ceiling. It looked like a black canvas with a chain with a spyglass hanging on the end of it. I climbed the ladder, you look through the spyglass, and in tiny little letters it says, "Yes." So it was positive. I felt relieved. It's a great relief when you get up the ladder and you look through the spyglass and it doesn't say no or fuck you or something. It said yes. When I heard about that historic moment from 1966 London 37 years later, Christ, I fell in love with her. To me, this anecdote sums up what I most admire about Yoko, her positivity. The spirit of everything she has created and continues to create is swaddled in an unmitigated message of quite simply, love. In the name of love, she perpetually challenges us to re-examine the dogmatic thinking of our time, to expand our emotional capabilities beyond the mediocre level of decency to which we've acquiesced. Quite possibly, the greatest artistic couple in the past century had met and begun to recognize the magic between them. John would never be the same, certainly, but in fairness, how could we ever blame Yoko for John's subsequent maturation? When anybody falls under the sway of true love, what use can there be in blaming the beloved? If you're an ardent fan of John, Paul, George, and Ringo, then the supposition that Yoko could have caused the Beatles' breakup, even indirectly, doesn't actually make much sense, particularly in the case of John, who was nothing if not an intensely discriminating individualist. That one of his life choices was to be with Yoko at that point was certain, but their relationship's blossoming had considerably less to do with the Beatles disbanding than John's own relationship with his mates. John said, "That was it. The old gang of mine was over the moment I met her. I didn't consciously know it at the time, but that's what was going on. That was the end of the boys, but it so happened that the boys were well known and weren't just the local guys at the bar." To accuse him of the pithless character that would have been required to in any way let Yoko break up the band, as though he had no free will to divorce himself from them of his own accord, is seriously demeaning to the man we reportedly admire so. Those of us who have chosen domesticity,